Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp. Well, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Influential She. I'm your co-host, Mel Schopp.
And I'm Deb Soholt. And we're just so delighted that you would choose to tune in. And we're just loving that we're hearing from women, like literally all over the world, about nuggets of wisdom that's coming from women, about our high leverage practices that are just really helping a lot of women get through things, which wasn't something that we really planned when we got going on this endeavor. But it is really fun to hear the conversation and story. And it just really hits home about how women are just in community. And they need community. And that's just part of who we are as people. And today we're going to be talking with an amazing person about perspicaciousness. Now, when we came up with this word for our high leverage practice, Mel, we actually had to go looking for it, didn't we? Because we were like, there's this thing of connecting these almost what seem disparate dots. They're not really, but just interconnecting multiple variables in the world and not seeing things as just a linear one lane. But seeing that all of these factors, whether or not it's in my bucket of work, still has a massive effect. And if we can connect those dots at the 10,000 foot level, it can really help us to accelerate our influence. Isn't that right, Mel?
Yeah. And I think that sometimes when people have this ability, it's almost frustrating for them when other people, it's like, you know, it's like, you don't see this, you don't get this, because it seems so intuitive and so natural. When you have this ability to be what we call perspicacious, because it's part of their DNA. And yet not everybody can do that, or not everybody is that way, but our guest is today, right, Deb?
Absolutely. And this is someone who, whether or not she knew she was living this word, has been living as a perspicacious woman. We're so happy to have with us Ann Wicks today. She is the director of the Ann Kimball Johnson Education Reform Initiative, but hold on to your seats. This is where it's at, the George W. Bush Presidential Center. So she is like doing amazing work in just really forwarding not only the conversation of education, but wrapped in the world of policy and politics. And how does that all fit together? You know, talk about being perspicacious. I think what's also so interesting, she's a Texas girl now, but, and I said that horribly wrong because, you know, here I am, you know, a woman of the plains. I can't do a Texas accent, so I shouldn't even try. But she came from our part of the world, growing up in Minnesota, was just a tremendous volleyball player. And so was recruited and went to Stanford. And her volleyball team, they actually have two national championships under their belt while she was a player there. And additionally, she went back and was an assistant coach and acquired a third national championship. So an incredible competitor. But where we're going to start, because we're going to get into some of this, you know, the perspicaciousness of politics and education and some of those kinds of things. But Anne, we just want to welcome you to the show and really begin with, how did you see that connecting the dots for yourself, like really looking at the 10,000 foot level when you're a Minnesota girl in, you know, what we would consider somewhat of a, you know, you're outside of Minneapolis in a suburb, but, you know, you're around a big place, but the community that you live in would be considered more Midwest, kind of smaller values thinking. Like, when did perspicaciousness start showing up for you?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. It's so fun to chat with both Deb and Mel. So I really have enjoyed our conversations and I'm looking forward to this one. But I think I'm a child of educators. I come from a family of educators, teachers, and professors. And so while I was not very worldly growing up in Lakeville, Minnesota, which is a great small Midwestern town. I had the luxury of going to the same school district from kindergarten all the way through when I graduated and from high school. But I was, you know, probably pretty sheltered, honestly, in that. But we read a lot, right? My mom's a big reader. We were always reading. So like I experienced the world through reading. I experienced the world through sports. We were just starting to, before we started recording, chatting about the Olympics. We always watched the Olympics. I was like, what is this? These people from around the world who have these vastly different experiences. And I understood for some of them, depending on where they're from, their ability to be great at sports was giving them access to something very different than people they would grow up with in their own countries. Like I started to see the world probably through the books I read, the sports I watched that were international, and, you know, conversations with my family who were, you know, sort of all educators and like to think about big issues and debate about big issues, were a tall Scandinavian family, absent my sister who is Korean. And, but everybody's very loud and opinionated. So we had boisterous dinner tables with uncles and aunts and grandparents and siblings, et cetera.
So, you know, and I think that your story of how you became really involved in, you know, this competitive edge is something not everybody has. So I think there's two things today that to me are so fascinating about you, the way in which you're seeing the world, but also this competitive edge that you had in this drive. Tell us a little bit about that and where that came from and how that really, you know, okay, so you're in Minnesota and all of a sudden, give us that next part of the story, because I love this part of your story.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't imagine being any other way. I was just always competitive. I loved competing. I'm tall and athletic. I'm 6'2". I've always been tall. You know, I always wanted to play sports, always wanted to compete. I love to win. I've always loved to win. I cannot pretend otherwise. So for me, being able to compete was really, was just a really important part of how I grew up. And my town was kind of a sports town. We had a lot of sports towns, but I had a coach early on. His name is Milan Mader, and he had escaped from the Czech Republic. He was an Olympic runner. He ran in Mexico City. He defected, and he ended up as a PE and health teacher in Lakeville, Minnesota. And he was one of my first coaches. And he had competed at the highest level on this big stage, and he had this fascinating personal story. And I think that getting to train and compete under Milan made a big difference. It gave me sort of an exposure to what that really looked like to be elite. And I had this sense of, oh, this could take me somewhere. I could do something with this. I could go play in college. My mom loves sports. Both my parents love sports. My mom is kind of a sports super fan. So we'd always go watch the state tournament. We'd watch, you know, I loved being able to watch girls and women who are a little older than I was compete and play. And I started to see, wow, I can go to college and do this. I always wanted to go to the Olympics. I never made it that far, but I wanted to be able to do this, which is probably why, you know, in January in Minnesota, I would be jumping rope in my garage in the cold because I wanted to train. And right, we didn't really belong to a health club. So I had to figure out how do you do that in, you know, 1987 or whatever in Lakeville, Minnesota? You go to your garage. So I couldn't have ignored, I think, that drive to compete, and sports was such a great outlet for me.
So Anne, when you were in Lakeville and you're kind of like saying, okay, my life and where I'm headed is bigger than this place. I mean, you could already see for yourself, you were inspired by someone, but you're also saying, okay, I see these incredible possibilities that I can move and be in a different direction. What was that like for you with the people that were surrounding you? Like, you've talked about your family already. And so I sense that, you know, they were very supportive and they're like, Anne, go, go, go. But were there times like within yourself that this, I'm connecting this world stage in my mind, I'm like moving in this other direction. Was that something you felt free to always talk about when you were growing up with your friends and with others? Or did you feel like, I have this thing and I'm just going to start to run with it, but I'm not so open about it with everyone else?
Well, I think that's an interesting, as upper Midwesterners, you will get this. People who know Garrison Keillor, you know, and they talk about everybody's good looking and strong. I think, and the kids are all above average, right? I think some people were surprised. My friends were very supportive. You know, they knew I wanted to do this, and I, you know, but I did things like, I didn't go to homecoming one year because I was on a college visit. You know, like I didn't, you know, there were times when I had to opt out of more traditional things because I was training and competing, and I started traveling to do that. And I think some people were kind of like, you know, what are you doing? You really think you're, you know, is it really out there what you see for yourself? And I just, and not so much that people would be discouraging, but I would sort of be one standard deviation, sometimes out of the norm, if that makes sense, in terms of what people were doing. And there were very few people who left our state, left Minnesota to go to college. That wasn't is common. There was a few of us who did from my class, but most people really stayed fairly close to home because it's a great place to grow up and people like to be there. And I just was different in my approach to it. And I think, I think some people were more supportive of that and wanted me to fly, and some were probably more puzzled by, you know, that desire. And I just kind of had to move forward.
So when you went to Stanford, you talked a little bit about, you know, really starting to feel this when we talked previously about this perspicacious idea when you were playing on your volleyball team.
Yeah.
And you would actually say things like, can you see the Matrix? Can you? And so, you know, it's a throwback to the movies, but yes, really this interconnected matrix. Talk more about that, Anne.
Yeah. Well, I think that volleyball is like the most quintessential team sport. You can have great people on your team, but no one person controls the action entirely. And so you're completely dependent on the people you're on the court with. You're completely dependent on the people you're training with to get you ready to be on the court with, you know, an actual competition. And so I think you learn a lot about how you have to have people working together to win. Like it's essential. It's impossible to win without that. So I think that was a really good training for that, to kind of see that how teams work together, where you have people who are really good at one thing and other people who are really good at another thing. That sounds so simple, but it was like, that was every day for us, repeated over and over and over again. We all had our own positions and our own specialties that we did on the team. If you're not that familiar with volleyball, it's like football, it's like basketball, where you've got, you know, people are specializing in their positions. The difference is in basketball, you could have one person who's great, who's running up and down the court and could score if they're just that much better than everyone else. In volleyball, there's several contacts per side on each play. And so I'd have to rely, if we were on a team together, I would have to rely on both of you to make great contacts when it was the ball comes to you so that I could make mine, right? And we could win a point. So I think that's kind of where this started to come together. And I think I started as an athlete too, understood our training was not just in the volleyball gym, right? There was a lot of things that we did on the track, in the weight room, running stadiums. There was a lot of things that were involved in helping us become really great and strong. And there was a number of people who worked with us to do that, you know, from trainers in the training room to our strength coaches, strength and conditioning coaches. You know, there's just a lot of people involved in making us national champions. And I think that just gives you a good sense of no woman is an island. And there's a lot of interconnected things that have to happen for great stuff to actually become real instead of just an idea. So that's probably years and years of that was sort of my grounding, I think, of how that could work. And something I probably translated then into professional life more and more as I've gotten older.
I was just going to ask you that, Anne, because you have just such a really a great, diverse sort of career that's taking you to where you are today. And I'm just kind of curious how you've translated all that and how you use it in your work today. But even some of those pieces back then, I mean, you were, you know, you taught, you did a number of different things, you lived in different places. How did that perspicaciousness kind of fit together with all your work? Because it's pretty fascinating when I look at your background.
Yeah, I wish I could say I had some like grand design that I was like making my way through. But I think I had to learn to balance confidence with curiosity, right? Like I think when you're younger, you can feel sort of brash and like, oh, I know this. Like, I'm so tired of hearing what other people think about this. I know this. Guess what? I'm like young and smart and I'll just sort of do my thing. And it doesn't take long, right, for your comeuppance to come in certain ways or others where, you realize, oh, wait, maybe I don't know everything. And so I think developing curiosity, I love working with really curious people, you know, because it helps sort of set that curiosity. So I think for me, I had to figure out how to balance the confidence and the curiosity and follow paths that were interesting to me. So it didn't occur to me. I didn't grow up in a business family. I grew up in a teaching and coaching family. I sort of thought maybe that's where I would go with my life. So I started teaching. I was, you know, started coaching in college. I thought maybe I want to follow that path, be an athletic director, something like that. And then I realized, but there's parts of this I really like. I like the strategy of how an athletic department runs. I don't love recruiting. Like, sort of, what does this look like? How are they getting money to fuel some of this? Which got me sort of into the fundraising side of the picture, which was, I'm a people person. I'm a goal-oriented person. So I enjoyed doing fundraising and development, but I really enjoyed that it gets you into strategic conversations about the vision for an organization and what sort of resources do you need to make that happen? I found that really fascinating. So it was sort of an interesting part that evolved through my professional life doing that. I had opportunities in California, in New York City. Like I just sort of let my curiosity take me sometimes. And I felt like every position that I did, I learned a lot. I learned more about a new sector. I learned from really skilled colleagues. I learned from sometimes less skilled colleagues about, okay, that's what I don't want to do, or I'm attracted to working to these kind of people. So I really see it as I sort of just collected smartness, or experience and insight along the way, stealing it as fast as I could from others that I worked with, right? It's sort of, that's how the matrix comes together, is because you have to really be, I think, thoughtful about being curious and reflective in that, which isn't always sort of innate. I don't know that I was innate without it, but more, how do you practice that over time?
And the reason I think that that's interesting, that's led to some of the things you've done, I've read some of the things you've written in the education space, and you can tell that it's not just this singular point of view, but it's like you've collected all of this, all of these different things throughout your experiences, and you put them in together into some really thoughtful pieces. I was reading your EduWonk on assessment, and it just is really obvious that that's not just from sitting in one sort of position over time, but it's really bringing together all those experiences you've had in those different places to be able to give this really thoughtful sort of way in which that you're talking and speaking.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. I mean, I have I work in a policy job now, but I am not really a policy wonk throughout my career, but I've sort of circled it always and sort of been involved in different ways. And I really, I feel like a kid in the candy store because I was an American studies major and I probably should have figured out how to go to DC right after I graduated, but I didn't. But I'm like, oh, guess what? I found my way to DC and it's in Dallas. And I get to work with these really, really smart, thoughtful people working on some big, complicated issues. And it's such a gift to me to be able to do that. But I think, President Mrs. Bush, our organization is sort of anchored around the vision and the values that they have. And they are like that. They don't oversimplify. I don't think they recognize the complexity of the world. They recognize sort of, the responsibilities we have if we care about things like freedom and accountability and compassion and opportunity for all. And those are big, complicated topics, and they require, some thoughtfulness. So to me, this is just, it's like a kid in a candy store to be here.
Anne, when I hear you talking about, when you were describing making your way to the Bush Center and being so curious, and then a little bit of this, and then, well, I like strategy, and I also like a little bit of policy, but I also like the education, but I'm learning and I'm collecting these bits that you were then able to tie into a direction for yourself. That's what perspicaciousness is all about, that there are all these other things. It's not, I'm interested in education, which is just, I'm interested in all of these variables and how they're coming together. And then you're talking about being in a role where you can lead perspicaciousness of, they're complicated, they're meaty, it's DC and Texas. It's like seeing it in a whole new way, and it leads to, a really juicy life. And we think it's a key point of accelerating influence, because if you can start to look above what you're in and how these come together, then you can accelerate your influence, because what the work that you're doing is never in isolation. It has to be bigger than the container with which you're educated, or your single family unit, or your small circle of friends. It has to be bigger than that if you really want to move something in an influential way.
Yes, yes, I think so. And I always think, Mel, you know this in education, right? It's so easy to get in the weeds with the acronyms and the really finite details, all of which can be important and meaningful. But I'm always reminded of, like, and this, you referenced the EduWonk piece, but I always think about like how we design for humans to actually do things that we think are beneficial. And Deb, you probably saw this in healthcare. I think this is healthcare thinks about this a lot. Like humans are sort of, we're kind of like weird and messy. We're not always logical. Sometimes we are, but we respond. Many people can respond well to the right kind of incentives and carrots. Shame is, can be like, or a stick can be a, an immediate sort of reaction, but it rarely gets you a good long-term result, right? So how do you think about how humans respond and use that as you're thinking about policy or interventions? And I sometimes just think we miss that piece of it. And I don't mean to soften it, right? That sounds kind of like squishy and wishy, but there are just, you know, schools and districts are very complex human environments. And you have to, if you ignore that, if you don't sort of acknowledge that true thing or say that true thing while you're thinking about how to improve the system, you're just kind of, as my dad would say, pissing in the wind, pardon the expression, right? Like it's just, we're just taking up space, you know, and pontificating, which is annoying. So anyway, I think about that a lot.
I just was reading something you had written that I loved. It said that you're regularly delighted and amazed by ingenious leaps forward. And it was from smartphones to the Fosbury flop, that it required imagination. And that's just how I see you. You're this person who loves the imagination and thinking forward and so forth. And not everybody has that. It's comfortable sometimes to just remain where we are. And that's how I've, you know, when I, the more I read about you and the more that I know about you, you really have taken all of those disparate pieces and put them together into something that helps you to really be this forward-thinking person.
Well, thank you. I wish I could say that I had some grand strategy, and I feel like I'm just fumbling my way around trying to learn and be useful, right? Like I just, at the end of the day, like what's the point if we're not actually being helpful? And I feel like this is a, you know, I mean, we could talk about how fraught this time is in general for people. You know, there's so many things from COVID to race discussions around the country that are like this is really complicated, and it's not simple, and it's not like, oh, there are easy solutions that if I could just shout louder, you know, we could solve for this. So I think it's a real, like, I'm like, be curious, just like the, like, if nothing else right now, you don't have to agree, but to be curious about if somebody's talking about something that you disagree with or you don't understand, to listen. I'm trying to discipline myself about that right now, is just to listen and think, because I don't have to agree with all of it, but I should probably pay attention and make sure I'm understanding where they're coming from. And it's hard to do that. I'm not always great at it, but that's something I've been really, really trying to do more of, particularly, I think, in the last 6 months or so. You know, it's a strange time in the world. It's what I hope that my son, who knows sort of what the world will look like. He's six going into first grade, but what does the world look like in 20 or 25 years? And I just like, what do I need to prepare him to do to be able to think and operate in a world that's changing so rapidly on just about every front? It can overwhelm you. So it's like, how do you take a bite out of this elephant and not lose your mind? You know, I think that's a challenge for everybody right now.
When we talk about being perspicacious and like moving to the 10,000 foot level and saying all these things are interconnected and affect each other, to your point about how do we even take a big bite out of this with all of these health changes and cultural changes and democracy changes and, you know, maturing into a new way of being together. And, yeah, you know, we're at one of these real transitional points, and we've had other transitional points, you know, throughout our country, but we're in a big one right now. And so sometimes people want to reduce that to something, one thing. It's just this one thing. If we could fix this one thing. And I understand that, because it's to your point, it's so overwhelming. That if you really rise up and try to think about all of it and not discipline yourself to not go to a fear space.
Yes.
Because it can seem so overwhelming and scary that you can't even take it on. And I think sometimes that's where, in staying curious and thinking about it, it's almost too big to think about it. So people almost go lower in their, how open they are in perspective, because it's difficult.
Yes. Yes, right. Doesn't your brain sort of shuts down when it's too much, right? Your brain will shut down. I think, and I'm not coming with any sort of like real solutions, but I think I'm a person of faith, right? We always talk about love God, love people. If you start there, if we start there, then what's the next thing we add in? But I think that's part of how, when there's chaos in the world, sort of what gives you grounding, if whatever that is for you, whether it's faith or something else, this is a time to be really clear about what anchors you and gives you purchase in a chaotic sort of fast moving space, which sometimes that can be hard to remember what that is. You know, what is that that'll help you? And then if you think about people, I think that's why I'm so curious about human-centered design right now. Like if you think about what actually is going to help people sort of stay in a, be able to sort of dial down conflict and sort of amp up actual the solution and then like dig in your heels shoulder to shoulder, because it's going to take some real work to stabilize what's happening for us as a country. I mean, we're getting into sort of bigger lofty issues, but I think about that a lot. Like that's not, pontification won't get us there, I think, but a lot of, you know, sort of humility might give us a fighting chance.
You know, one of our other high leverage practices, the high leverage practice of voice, we talk about raising your words and not your voices. And it really is, you know, surrounding that idea that, you know, if we think carefully about what we're going to say. And I love that you also really believe strongly in the power of having conversations with people, even though, you know, we need to get back to that, to have conversations with people that maybe are not, that we don't totally agree with, because they're all good people. We're all good people, basically, and humanly. But to be able to see how that all puts together and how that fits together is so critically important if we're going to ever heal ourselves and get back to where what we believe is some sense of normalcy.
Yeah. And I think the people who are shouting the loudest, if you listen to some of them, like if you're like, oh, I usually listen to this shouter, because they're all over the place on every side of every issue, that to sort of, I don't know, I'm like, now I'm trying to decide who to listen to. And I'm like, what is their personal upside? Right? Like sort of they're putting something out in the world. What is their upside for this? Because for some people, it's not that's not necessarily for good. It's hard to see that their path is for good, right? It might be something else. And I think that kind of discernment is helpful. And usually the closer to the ground you get, meaning like if in education, if you're talking to educators, you're talking to parents, right? Talking to get closer to the ground. I think in a lot of places in healthcare, stay close to the ground. One of the things I loved, we had a chance, and I referenced this, I think in the piece you were talking about, Mel, that Dr. Deb Burks, who was sort of in the cauldron in the White House leading the COVID-19 response for a while in the Trump administration. She's a longtime public health expert, seen lots and lots of things, but she talked about the importance of just staying close to the ground, because you might design a policy in a room with all the right kind of intentions, but it may be adapted and implemented in such different ways, and people may solve for something in a really unexpected way, you know, and how important that is to be aware of that, because it doesn't, like the policy's only as good as how it's being implemented. And if you're not paying attention to that connection, you're just kind of selling everybody short. And we shouldn't be surprised when we're like, oh, it just didn't go as planned or it didn't work. Well, we probably got a design problem, right? We probably got something else going on. Like it's important to be really, you know, curious about that kind of thing.
So Anne, somebody listening to this could say, whoa, you've just got yourself all put together and,
oh my gosh,
you know, there hasn't been vulnerability within being this perspicacious viewpoint, because we hear from people, women that have lived this, I see multiple things that connect together, that sometimes it can feel alone, or I feel kind of weird, or I just, how do I fit with others? What kind of things have you had to work through to start to build your confidence in this arena?
Well, number one, I do not have anything together at all.
None of us do.
I mean, oy. I have the benefit of, I'll say one thing that was so awesome for me, and I'm just so grateful, is going to Stanford, because I got to be around all these people who are super smart and a little bit weird, right? They're a little weird because everybody is smart. They're really, really good at something, way smarter than me. And I was like, oh, there's the freedom of being around people who are unabashed about being smart and wanting to do big things was a marvelous, freeing experience. And I'm forever grateful that I had a chance to go to college there and be an athlete. It was just an absolute blessing and gift to me. And the great part is I have, you know, all these years later, what is it? Oh my gosh, this fall it'll be 30 years since I was a freshman in college. That was a challenge to sort of think about there. But the, you know, we're all still friends. There's so many of us that are really good friends, and we haven't had a chance to really see each other that often, especially in the last couple of years, but we stay in touch through text and WhatsApp, and we have these very meaty conversations. Sometimes they're kind of funny, but I really appreciate their perspective on things. We were just on the big issues of the day. We're not all aligned politically. We do different things professionally. Pretty much everybody has got some sort of big thing that they are doing. I'm impressed with them. And I value the chance to sort of get their perspective on big issues. But I also value we're now at the stage where everybody is totally banged up and had been like kicked in the teeth professionally, been kicked in the teeth personally, a marriage, parenting, you name it, right? Like, I think about like, you know, sometimes at the ends of a movie when there's a battle scene and like out of the mist, the hero comes like staggering through and you're like, oh, he lived, but he's like bleeding. You know, I'm like, we've all like staggered out and we're like, still here, but crap, this is, you know, it's hard. And I think it's great to sort of have a community of friends who've all experienced this in different ways because there's a real strong empathy and wisdom. So I have all these, you know, a lot of women that I really listen to, some who I know and some who I don't, you know, that I just really, I appreciate their like this, that they keep staggering out, you know, and showing up and sharing a little bit about what it's been like. I don't know. Cause we're all getting kicked in the teeth.
So Anne, what advice would you give? Like, and I mean this like, not in a way that you're holding yourself up as having the answers to your point earlier in the podcast, but, you know, for people to become more perspicacious, what would you say to women? How would you tell them to take a step forward in that direction?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. I would say sort of like cultivate your curiosity, you know, cultivate your curiosity because, that's where the good stuff is, you know, in unexpected places and people who sit outside your sector and read and you know, sort of cult, like I would be deliberate about your curiosity. So when I say that, it could literally be, okay, I'm going to identify this is, if you do Enneagram, I'm like a type 3, I'm a ENTJ, you know, like I'm a goal oriented. I like having a structure. So like, go find 3 authors you're going to start following on Twitter, or Instagram, or books that you're going to read and sort of be deliberate in that way, like, you know, and get just like develop your muscle. Like, what does that mean to be curious or read a different newspaper? If you read something that has typically one slant, read something else too, and just sort of think about how they tell the same stories differently, that kind of thing.
That's really great advice. Yeah.
Well, Anne, we just can't thank you enough and just really appreciate you coming on our podcast and talking a little bit about being perspicacious. And it's been really fun to get to know you and to really challenge all of us to really start moving our influence forward, to realize that we're all together in the battle, trying to arise out of the wreckage, whatever that wreckage is, because that's just the human experience. And you're not alone in that. Everybody's got it. But a way forward is to stay curious. Like, okay, this is interesting, even if it's terribly painful. I could stay curious about what could this help me with? How could I take this, no matter how painful it is, and actually turn it into something better? And to move forward with others in this space of curiosity and imagination, that this may be what it is in the moment, but if we can connect up some things that maybe are unusual and we wouldn't have seen it that way, it can help us to take another step forward. So,
yes.
Really appreciate you being on the show, and we just appreciate everyone that would tune in to Influential She. We like to leave you with a question. So today, where are you being curious? Where are some areas where you could think about opening up a new curiosity even to something that you disagree with or something that you don't want to hear, and stay curious and really listen. We want to thank you all for tuning in to another episode of Influential She. We hope you'll do it again.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at teachbetter.com/podcasts, and we'll see you at the next episode.